welcome to A Handful of Dust, a podcast about Neil Gaiman's The Sandman and its spin-offs. I'm Jenny.
And I'm Eamon. Hello.
And as always, we start with a content note. Some of The Sandman comics deal with dark and troubling subject matters, and we might refer to them or discuss them in depth in these episodes. For more information about the topics in the books and in this podcast, you can see the show notes. And you can also email us for more details. We'll say that we know that there are two particular topics in this one coming up, so please do check the content note before listening.
And let's start with some housekeeping. So first of all, this is rather unusual. You might notice a change in sound quality. We are in the same room.
It's the same room.
For the first time in well over 6 months. One other housekeeping item I've got from the wake is that we received a question from one of our listeners, Timothy, who asked us if we could help identify the character with the purple flower face who appears on the first page of chapter 2 of The Wake at the funeral. And the answer is we couldn't identify them. We think they've appeared, this character's appeared somewhere else in one of the Dreaming spin-offs, but we can't remember it or find it at the moment. So if anybody knows who the purple flower face character is, if somebody's got the annotated Sandman and can look it up for us, then please get in touch with the email address mcbcpodcast@gmail.com and we'll pass it on to Timothy. apart from that, I don't think we've got any other housekeeping, have we?
Don't think so.
Okay, so this is the first Death miniseries, Death, the High Cost of Living, a three-issue miniseries that came out from March to May 1993, which puts it right about the end of Brief Lives. No idea if he intended to do this mini-series right from the start or if he was just, I guess, like everybody else, overtaken by the popularity of Death as a character in The Sandman. I should mention we've got art by Chris Pacello and Mark Buckingham, colours by Steve Olive, lettered, as always, by Todd Klein. I guess Dave McKean covers, did we have?
They look like they could be.
Yeah, they do look like Dave McKean covers, don't they? Yes, so probably yes. Okay, so first of all, do you remember this one particularly?
I do. I remember the Death spin-offs particularly well, I think, because I liked them a lot. Like Brief Lives and A Game of You, they were the ones that really stuck with me. And the characters in them, I don't know, there's something very good about the, like, very short, quick day-in-the-life character thing that basically happens. So, yeah, I do remember them.
Okay, so I should say we've got two versions in front of us. We've got a hard copy, which I think just contains the three issues and the Death and John Constantine public safety announcement one at the end. The digital version has got some other stories in it.
Yeah.
It's got The Sound of Her Wings, issue 8 of The Sandman, which we've talked about in our very first episode. Very important issue. It's got Facade, which was the one with
Element Girl,
Urania Blackwell, which was in Dream Country, and we did like that one quite a lot, but we talked about that on episode 3. It's got a couple of other little stories, which we'll get to in just a moment. Both, I think, the digital and the hard copy have got introductions by Tori Amos, who long-time friend and collaborator with Neil Gaiman. And I think you can sort of see a bit of Tori Amos in some of the musical references, both in this miniseries but also in the main Sandman. I think one of her songs is actually quoted in Brief Lives, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. And there's, I think in her introduction, she's talking about Death and also about Delirium, the two characters that sort of she relates to. And there's a reference to Neil Gaiman saying that she's quite a lot like Delirium. But definitely the music, this spin-off and the other Death spin-off are incredibly 90s Tori Amos music vibe, like, so much. It's just, it's all there. And, like, I think once you start listening to Tori Amos's music, which I didn't do until after I'd read these books, you start to see the, like, the world and the vibe that's going on. And there was lots of different I guess, musical styles in the 90s, and this is one very particular one I think is captured.
Yes, and there's a very sort of 90s club scene, isn't there? Yeah, going to a music club. Okay, I've done a lot of talking. Why don't we, before we get to the main event of the three issues, we've got another story which I'd completely forgotten about, which we've identified does not exist in my collection, horrors, called...
It's called A Winter's Tale.
Right.
So in the digital version, it just is right before the start of A High Cost of Living, and it's a five-page little mini issue. And there's not a whole bunch to it. It's a little bit of character building for Death, and also the establishment of this idea that once every century,
yeah,
she takes day off or day in the world, and she becomes mortal for a day. And so she understands what it is that she's taking from people. She understands her job. And I think I felt like there's a reference to that in the main Sandman run.
Yes, there is. I can't remember which volume it occurs in, but there is definitely one reference
to that. There's definitely a reference to it. I think there's a reference to one of her previous days where, yes, she spends it somewhere else. But this is obviously, you know, we mentioned the sound of her wings and Facade being at the start of this, of the digital collection, as a sort of like intro to Death as a character, if you didn't know about her. And so this little five-page thing just gives you that little bit of context that's going to let you get into High Cost of Living, which is a day in the life, the day of the life of Death. In the 90s.
Yes. I seem to remember we saw a previous incarnation of her where she was a Chinese girl sitting on the riverside with a boy.
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, I seem to remember that. And in the Winter's Tale one, am I right in thinking that many, many centuries ago, a young girl said to her, "How would you like it?" or something like,
yes,
that. And so as a result, she does this one day every century where she finds out what it is that she's taking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything else to say about The Winter's Tale? I mean, it just sets up this one, doesn't it?
It does. I think it sets up it nicely. It's interesting. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about this. I mean, it's one of the questions we've had quite a lot come up in the podcast of which issue you start people with, which trade you start people with. And I think the digital issue here provides you with the ability to give this collection to someone without having them read The Sandman. I mean, that first issue might be a bit confusing because you'll have no idea who Dream is, and then he won't come up again later and you'll be like, well, who was that guy? But yeah, you have the ability here to be like, you might not like Sandman, and you know, we've mentioned why there might be reasons why a full read through of Sandman might be a sort of not something you're willing to do, not something you're able to do, because it's a lot of books to buy or borrow. And so this, you get a little snippet, you get straight to Death, who's like a lot of people's favourite characters. So
you get A Sound of Her Wings, you get Facade, which is great, you get this Winter's Tale, which is great stuff, and then you get into
the spin-offs,
the mini-series.
Yeah.
And obviously we will be doing the other mini-series. We're probably going to do it at the end of our podcast adventure. Yeah. Okay. We're saving something for the end.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've hinted at it. People know this is Death's one day off in 100 years, and she's going to spend it in the 90s.
I like that we sort of, Dream has a, not a day off, but he has his 100 years meeting with Hobgadlin.
Yes.
Which happened, is it 1989 that happens?
Yeah, something like that. When the
like, sort of last one.
Yeah.
And then like Death's obviously happens every, in 1993 or something.
Yeah, she gets 1993,
that.
She yeah. gets a day off. Okay, so that's the basic outline. She gets her day off. As we've hinted, she is in 1993 New York. It's very 90s, isn't it?
It's so 90s.
And it's going to involve, as we've suggested, the world of music and a club, visit to a club. The universe does this weird thing where it creates a life for her. So it's just like, it fits her into this life as if she'd always existed as this character who rather charmingly is called or referred to as Dee Dee.
Yeah, Dee Dee.
All the D's. Before we get onto some of the sort of nitty gritty of this series, what about the artwork and the look of it, and particularly the look of Dee Dee?
I mean, the artwork is very 90s.
Yes.
I think I've sort of mentioned this a couple of times when we've been talking, but there's some of the artwork is for me too 80s, and some of it is not. Some of the style that I like to read, and this feels very comfortable to me and very familiar, and it sort of has those like rounded edges that you'll find in like almost superhero comic books. I'm thinking of like some X-Men that I've read, you know, this sort of that line of drawing has, that style has continued in like contemporary works as well. So I think it's a very familiar style.
Right.
And it's very 90s, as we keep saying. And death is, I think, I would say this is the death, death. This is the death that everyone thinks of when they picture her.
A peak look for death.
Yeah,
isn't
I mean,
it?
She doesn't have a huge range of style unless she's dressing up for formal attire at Destiny's or something. But we see her, she's wearing like black jeans, a black tank top. We'll see her in a black jacket and a black hat, a top hat, with her eyeliner and her silver ankh necklace. And I think even you get a little hint of like some pointy goth boots as well, maybe in certain angles. Yeah, I think this is, you know, like I said, death doesn't have a lot of variety, but this is the
she looks great.
She looks great, and I think this is the one that like I would think of if I'm thinking of like how does death look. I think of this artwork.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think she definitely captures a very particular aesthetic that you know, has always had come back and gone out of style in various points, this sort of gothic black eyeliner, silver jewelry look, you know. You'll find it in lots of different places, and it's, I can see why aesthetically a lot of people loved death and maybe even styled themselves after death, and it's a good Halloween costume for a lot of people in the same way that Delirium is. There's really something in the style that speaks to how young women were dressing, I think, at the time, and how young people dress now, even, because it's all coming back.
It's all coming back, yes. And jeans with ripped knees are still a thing for the male character, which we'll get to in a minute.
Yes.
I know she does have one little splash of colour other than the black and silver. She has a yellow smiley button on her lapel. Apparently not necessarily a reference to Watchmen or to Boss Smiley in the
Prez issues.
But yeah, okay. It's a great look. Great artwork for Death, or Dee Dee as she is in this one. And appropriate enough for the smiley button, she is her usual delightful presence, isn't she? She walks through this 24 hours of New York just about enjoying everything. I mean, there's some dark stuff that they're going to get into, which is obviously not so enjoyable. But in terms of experience in life, she has a pretty good time, doesn't she?
She does have a pretty good time. I would say she almost veers into that dreadful trope of manic pixie dream girl.
Ooh.
I think it's probably saved by the fact that she's not a real human. She's like, you know, she's not a real person. You know, if you got that sense, like, she seems like she'd be awesome, but also maybe if you met her in real life, she'd be terrible. And that's kind of the like defining feature of a manic pixie dream girl, I think. I guess the only thing that separates her from that trope is that that trope is usually set up to serve and flatter a male character. And here she basically takes none of the bullshit that's given by any of the male characters. She sort of floats along and ignores them or just like drags them along.
Yeah.
In a way that is not, you don't usually find in that particular trope. But I guess this is gonna become peak manic pixie dream girl time in a couple of years after this, I guess, in film.
Right.
I'm trying to think about the most well-known examples are in the noughties, but I feel like they start at this point.
Kirsten Dunst, Zooey Deschanel.
Yeah, they're the ones that people that defined the genre, but it definitely predates that, I believe.
Right. Oh, I hadn't really thought about that. Manic Pixie Dream Girl, Death, or Dee Dee in New York for 24 hours. But generally, I mean, just enjoying hot dogs and apples and being given free breakfast and free everything, basically. There's a weird sort of in-joke that she never pays for anything. The universe provides for her.
Exactly. And I think you know, like we saw her in Sound of Her Wings when we first meet her. We know that this is her vibe, and also like it goes hand in hand with the realities of her job of like she is sunny and delightful because of the seriousness of her job, because it's not, you know, she can't mope like Dream, because if she moped like Dream, it would be all over.
Yeah.
And A Winter's Tale gives you a hint of that, of like there was a time when she wasn't sunny and happy, or that she moped like Dream, and now she sort of moved through it, and this day is the sort of solution to that, a day where she gets to enjoy what life has to offer. So she's just happy. She's happy to be at a garbage dump, which is when we first meet her. She's there breathing, as she says, which is, I think is a really, it's like just a really funny line. What else would you do at a garbage dump?
Yes, enjoy breathing. The smell. Yeah. Yes. All right, so let's talk about her companion through this 24 hours in New York, which is a teenage boy called, with the amazing name of Sexton Furnival.
Yes.
I'm pretty much used to my name by now. It's the last thing I'm ever going to write, he says. Before we tackle the two thorny issues, what about Sexton as a character?
Sexton's a pretty good character, I think. He's a pretty interesting teenage boy. Maybe if we want to, like, pull out his tropes, he does have a little bit of that, like, Holden Caulfield, like, vibe of just like everything sucks, the world is awful.
Yes.
He's a teenage boy in the 90s, so you know it makes sense. Everything is awful for a teenage boy in the 90s at this point. He has a really good sort of like, I wouldn't say grunge, I would say like soft grunge.
Yes. You
know, he's like got the baggy cardigan and the t-shirt and the ripped jeans and the shoegazer haircut, but I don't know whether it's just how the art is done. But he's a very clean...
clean grunge.
Yeah, it's clean grunge. It's, you know, it's a...
He's fairly well-off grunge. His dad is some sort of music showbiz lawyer in LA, I think, who's
and
left...
his mum owns a restaurant.
Yeah, so he's quite well-off grunge. And yes, he mopes through with... constantly amazed by Dee Dee, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I think that, like, this, the sort of in-text signal that he's maybe not the true grunge is the bit where... he gets angry that his, or he gets upset that his jeans have ripped more, and Dee Dee's like, why do more rips matter? And when she mends them for him, and she's like, I kept the ones I thought you wanted to keep, like,
yes,
which I think is a very like true representation of that like 90s grunge, the way it filtered down from Kurt Cobain basically and the Seattle music scene, of being like, it was very artfully done, it was, there was money behind the grunge by the time it became like a fashion.
Is he middle class grunge?
I think he's middle class grunge. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so he's got his connection to, as you say, there's his mom, there's his dad. His dad has something to do with the music business, and that will have, I suppose, a nice little knock-on effect, because when they're at the New York Music Club, we bump into Hazel and Fox.
Hazel and Fox are back.
Hooray!
And like, you know, you said, like, Neil Gaiman taking the opportunity to write more about death and do the spin-off. Maybe it wasn't planned. Maybe he just was like, death is popular, people want more death, which is a weird sentence to say. That Hazel and Foxglove also fell into that category of, like, people want more Hazel, people want more Foxglove. And to, like, tie them up here is really lovely. And also they'll go on to continue to be in these spin-offs.
Yes, we'll talk about them more when we get to the other Death miniseries. But
yeah.
I mean, I was delighted to see Hazel and Foxglove again, particularly as they both seem to be doing okay.
Yeah.
You know, Hazel seems much more together than she perhaps did in A Game of You.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that, about the characterization of Hazel in response to her pregnancy and how she's sort of painted as quite naive and childish in a way. But here she's owning her pregnancy. She's wearing a t-shirt that has the word has baby with an arrow pointing down. She's I think they keep saying that she's about to give birth. She's like any day now kind of vibe. And then it has like Dyke scrawled on it and with an arrow pointing up. So she's very much like engaged with her pregnancy in a way that's not shown in A Game of You.
Yes.
And a lot happier. And obviously Foxglove is doing her music now and do we get, yeah, we get the song lyrics, so we find out that Foxglove's music is about sort of the things that have happened in the Sandman.
Yes.
So about Judy in the issue 24 Hours, and about Wanda in A Game of You, and then later on there's more references, I think, so.
Yeah.
Foxglove's way of understanding everything wild and crazy that's been happening to them is through her music.
Yes, so Foxglove is performing at this club, which is how Sexton and Dee Dee get in, because Hazel gives them comps on the door, I think, whatever it's called. And a chance conversation in the club between Sexton and a, what do they call them, an A&R guy?
A&R guy, yeah.
Yeah, and when he realises who Sexton's dad is and that Sexton likes Foxglove's music, this seems to be, it's just a little side note that it seems to be the start of Foxglove being discovered as a musician, doesn't it?
At her first gig.
At her first gig.
Seems very impressive.
Singing songs about some awful things that have happened over the run of the Sandman up until this point. Okay. When I read it, I identified two problematical areas.
Yeah.
For me. Now, I don't know if we will find out in a moment whether they're the same problematic areas that you've discovered.
I think they probably are. I think the big one that is sort of unavoidable is suicide.
Yes.
And suicide ideation as a sort of the main... Well, it's the introduction we get to the story, because that's... Sexton introduces the story by writing his suicide note.
Yes. He's typing on a 1993 computer, and he's typing basically his explanation about why he sees no point in carrying on with anything, and it's his suicide note, yes.
I think it's also worth noting that reading that with... I don't think it takes... I mean, maybe just as an adult brain reading that, you read a teenager's maybe slightly melodramatic suicide note.
Yes.
And actually, you know, the connection to whether those thoughts are, like, truly representing what he feels is sort of questionable, I think. You know, we talked about, you know, there's not to say there's, like, he's not ticking boxes, but we're shown that he's not really interested in killing himself, but rather that this is something else. He's expressing teenage angst through this very typical fashion, which is, like, suicide ideation, maybe. And I think in the when he meets Dee Dee, he falls and is trapped in a garbage dump, and he calls for help, and that's sort of,
yes,
I like that flip side of him being like, it's all over, I'm ending it, it's done, and then he falls and he's like, actually no, help me.
Yes.
And it's not really focused on, but there is, yeah, I think we're given the indication that his feelings are very teenaged. Not to say that teenagers don't contemplate suicide or seriously, but to say that, like, his character is not shown to be suicidal necessarily, but is shown to be, like, going through some suicide ideation in a way.
Yes, and he's talking about it very much at the start.
Yeah.
And I did feel, because this is a 24-hour story, basically, a much better one than the previous 24-hour story yes. that we had in the first Sandman trailer, but this is a 24-hour story, and by the end of the 24 hours, his experience with Dee Dee will have basically convinced him of the benefits of life, of, you know, the importance of living and enjoying things, which is slightly, I thought, neat and writerly in a way. It's a bit quick.
Yeah.
From suicidal ideation teen at the start of the three issues, and then at the end of the three issues, he's sort of, oh, it's all right, actually. I'll give it a go.
Yeah, he is put through the ringer a little bit, though. There is some stuff. Because there is a character death at some point which he witnesses.
Yes.
So maybe not, you know, maybe it's portrayed as him being convinced of something in life, but also, you know, maybe he just gets that teenageness of, like, distraction and something else to think about that sometimes I think is quite relatable for a teenager going through an angsty phase, you know?
Yes.
Sometimes actually what you need is a friend and someone to pull you out of it rather than...
And Dee Dee, for 24 hours, does become that friend, doesn't she? Yeah.
She basically insists on it.
Yes. And as you said earlier about her character, she doesn't take any nonsense from him in a way.
Yeah.
She doesn't tolerate BS death anyway. But yeah. Okay. I mean, again, I wonder about these things 27 years later, whether now Neil Gaiman would write it with something slightly more nuanced and, I don't know, weighty about suicidal ideation and not just as a sort of character development from start to finish. But
yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, it could have been buying into that grungy aesthetic of
Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, hating the world, thinking everything is futile, and that sort of vibe, which is kind of a gross way to describe it, but that, you know, that will tied into that idea at that time.
Yeah, I did get that sort
of. I guess Kurt Cobain is 1993.
Is he? Is that when? Right.
I think it's around. Then,
and Sexton does look like a slightly middle class, well scrubbed, grungy Kurt Cobain.
I didn't zoom in on any of his walls, but I presume there might be a poster.
We'll probably
or two.
Find a Nirvana poster up there somewhere.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay, so we should.
Yeah, that could be actually could be a Kurt Cobain in the background.
There you go. Yes. So we mentioned it at the start. Content note: this does have suicidal ideation and sort of content in a way.
Yeah.
You mentioned that they go through the ringer because there are two characters, two of Neil Gaiman's, I sort of call them supernatural characters, both of whom are obviously, again, you get the impression they're two of the long-living characters in The Sandman, both of whom know that death takes this one day a year, both of whom basically want to find her. Mad Hettie.
Yeah.
Always a good time with Mad Hettie.
Always
does.
A good time with Mad Hettie.
She's looking for her heart. I don't know why in the Sandman universe everybody has a little inanimate object version of their heart, which is hugely important. But anyway, there's Mad Hettie, and then there's this character, the Eremite, some sort of mad religious hermit who wants death's ankh for some reason.
Yeah. It's all about symbols.
Symbols and power. And he sets basically a trap for Dee Dee and Sexton. And they end up trapped in some sort of warehouse where they can't get out. And then there's a, as you say, there's a bad guy with them who's not the Eremite who ends up dead. So Sexton does witness some stuff. So there's all that going on. It felt like story stuff, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think any time Mad Hettie pops up, we get a sense of, like, what we're seeing in The Sandman is just a glimpse of this, like, wild world that's going on out there. You know, we know quite a lot about Hobgadlin.
Yes.
But Mad Hettie presumably has a story like Hobgadlin's of when she decided to not die and just continue to live because she's 250 at this point.
Yes.
I think the implication here is that her heart is something to do with it. Like, she's hidden her heart from death deliberately, and now she needs Dee Dee
to find her.
And then she's going to hide it again at the end. So, yeah, but Mad Hattie's great. I think just she has, like, a broad Cockney accent, which is always fun to read written down. Yeah, and then the Eremite and his little, like, errand boy almost who Sexton knows is a guy from school that Sexton knows of they just like pop up and you sort of get very quick context of who they are, but all you know is they're after death and 24 hours, that's all you're gonna know, you know.
Yes, exactly. We don't get an awful lot of time. They have to get on with it, don't they? They have to get the trap. The guy, the school bully, the sort of smart, well, I don't know smart, but you know, the sort of sexy school bully has to lure them to this room, this warehouse, which he says is a club, in order to get death and to get her ankh.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Mad Hettie, yeah. If we ever got that World's End miniseries that we wanted, where there was female-based stories from the World's End I'd take a Mad Hettie issue.
Yeah, I think that would be really good. She's always fun when she pops up, and she only ever pops up for a few panels. I feel like this is the most consistent backstory we get, consistent story we get for her. Like, we find out she actually has some kind of like magical witchy powers.
Yes.
We see her in London. I like there's an image of her on top of St. Paul's, I think. And I guess any other Neil Gaiman fans might feel what I felt, which was like, ooh, this is Neverwhere. She's a character in Neverwhere, definitely. She exists in that world as well. So I like that a lot.
The miniseries starts with Mad Hettie. She's got this deal with this sort of weird, punky gang of girls in London, and they have to get her a dove, I believe.
Yeah.
And then they try to renege on the deal and steal her money, and she, as you say, displays some weird witchy-like powers, although she insists she's not a witch. But you don't get to be 250 years without learning a thing or two, Miss Clever Boots, she says. And then she's, as you say, she looks like she's on the dome of St. Paul's, with a beautiful view over London, and she's using the dove for, what do you call it, augury, prophecy? You know, yeah. She looks at the dove's entrails to work out where death's going to come back. And yes, when I saw that, doves, pigeons, St. Paul's, I thought, oh, she's in the Neverwhere universe.
She is.
The Neverwhere universe
and the Sandman universe are the same.
They sort of knock into each other here in this issue. Okay. There's a moment at the music club.
There is.
Before the stuff goes down in the warehouse and the school bully will get killed and die in front of Sexton and all that, there's a moment in this music club which is strange and jarring. Shall I say that?
Yes. I think... Yeah. I don't...
Sexton meets a young woman of about his age.
Yes. So we sort of see Dee Dee goes off and gets charmed by the bully. Or rather, Dee Dee just goes along with the flow, which is her vibe. And Sexton meets a woman wearing gloves, a young woman wearing gloves, with hennaed hair.
Yes.
I will say that her character, although we so briefly see her...
2 pages.
She sort of matches Dee Dee's vibe a little bit. She has a very similar sort of... She kind of talks down to Sexton a little bit and, like, calls him on his bullshit. And at the end of the story, there's the implication that she wants to see him again.
Yes.
And that they will meet up again.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we don't... There's another person that Sexton interacts with, which we might quickly mention as well after this. But Sexton is very clear that he doesn't have friends. He mentions that, I think, in his... along the way, maybe even at the beginning in his suicide note. And that Dee Dee is a friend to him that day. And so there's the opportunity here for this new person, who I don't think we get a name for her.
No, she's not named.
But she's referred to as Gloves.
Yes.
That will be the friend, right?
Yeah.
He's going to meet her at the next thing. And
there's going to be a party at Hazel and Fox's, a baby shower or something, I think. Yes. And she's going to be there, and she specifically wants Sexton to come to this party.
So there's interesting elements to this character. The problematic element comes in here because she provides another reason for Sexton to rethink his suicide. And I think we've talked a little bit about this in other issues as well. This is particularly referring to sexual abuse. And I don't really want to go into it too much because I don't think it's very well handled, and I don't think it's worth exploring super in-depth why, because I think it's pretty obvious. I think we mentioned it in a couple of early issues to say references like this, these super dark ideas, which are very real things that happen a lot, sadly, are thrown into the Sandman as throwaway moments, as sort of pulling in a gritty, dark element. And I think, I'm trying to think, there was definitely one, I think, in another trade where it was like one panel and we were like, you know, is it necessary to have one panel that goes this dark, this suddenly, and then pull us straight back out of it?
Yes, that was, when one of the worlds seen through despair's mirrors.
And here I think it feels similarly. It feels like an excuse to bring the story much darker and to give a little bit of, like, reality, maybe a little injection of like, this is what people who are really going through mental health crises might be influenced by, you know, might be the cause of these things. And to give, but the fact that it's used to give Sexton motivation, or even, he doesn't even seem to be listening, as you know, a couple of times he's not really paying attention, but here he doesn't really seem to be like paying attention to what's being said. And so I think you have to question, like, what is the point of this, the introduction of this idea and this little bit of narrative that we don't explore, we don't find out much more about. And there's also,
it's a very weird page, because she tells Sexton a story
as if it isn't her, but I think it's
clearly her that she's telling the story about. Clear to everybody, perhaps, except Sexton,
who
doesn't
listening.
Seem to be listening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did wonder about this moment and what Neil Gaiman was trying to tell us. I mean, you know, as you say, it's very dark. It's a description of something extremely dark and unpleasant. And nobody really hears her story, except maybe we do as the reader.
Yeah.
You know.
And again, I think there's a, you know, there's a value to representing these stories and to bringing these kind of things into the light. I'm not sure if that this place, three panels in a three-issue mini-sode of a big run of comics where the focus is on the male characters mostly, is the place to do that.
Mm.
And I'm not sure if Neil Gaiman is necessarily the person to do that, to the writer or even the artist as well, to bring that in. So I think it, you know, we've talked about how the Sandman reaches for these much darker points that were maybe very new to comics in their late 80s and 90s, but now are kind of have become tropes, which is not a very fun thought to think about. So we're a little bit more used to them, but I don't think that we should be used to them. I think we should still look at these three panels and be like, oh, or even, you know, because in acknowledging that, we have to acknowledge that there are people who would not be able to read those three panels and turn the page and be like, oh, that was odd. You know, there are people for whom these discussions would be of a lot more importance, and having them treated sort of not that it's treated flippantly, but, you know, just because of the space that it's given or the like focus that it's given doesn't feel like it's being, like we said, it's just an extra element that's added in here to bring a depth and a darkness, and it seems like it's at the expense of anybody who might have experienced these kind of things.
Yeah. Okay, very strange.
Yeah, and I think it's a real shame, because the rest of these issues, you know, obviously we talked about suicide, but it's not, that is the concern of this issue, you know, the idea of suicide, of ending your life, is sort of explored, and it's explored very quickly in only three issues, but it is being explored, whereas this issue doesn't seem to be explored in any way.
And we perhaps should mention again, content note, that does mention on this one page not only sexual abuse but also self-harm.
Yes.
I wish, again, you know, our listeners might be able to point me in the right direction, but if there's more from Sexton and Gloves in other issues, I'd sort of like to see a bit more of that story and find it explored in a bit more depth than just this one page.
Yeah.
Maybe when he clicks at the end of the book, not only that there's a young woman with henna hair who wants to see him again, but he might also click to what she was telling him.
Yeah. Let's hope that Sexton is a good and supportive friend and doesn't
yes.
continue to ignore the signs that Gloves is quite clearly giving here.
Yes.
Yeah, and I was going to mention, just while we're talking about problematic issues, I was going to mention Sexton's other friend, who he doesn't really acknowledge, but is definitely a presence because we see him often, is Billy.
Billy.
His next door neighbour, who is shown to be disabled and unable to speak, but is communicating with Sexton. He's shown in a wheelchair. And I think there's some nice elements in the way Sexton interacts with Billy, and even Mad Hetty interacts with Billy later on. But there are also some phrases, turns of phrase, that Sexton uses that feel a little bit ableist. And I think now Neil Gaiman would be taken to task for including them. There's a reference, I think Sexton says, "You don't have much of a life, do you, Billy?" And I think that's like a, you know, that's a throwaway statement again that is put in here, but is not true. Disabled people live full and happy lives, and it's not up to abled people to decide the extent to which they live their life. So I just felt like I like Billy and I like that he's included, but it just could have been better.
So my medical diagnosis would be that Billy has severe cerebral palsy and is in a wheelchair, and as you say, he's has communication difficulties, although Sexton seems to either understand him or just probably uses him as a sort of sounding board, somebody to talk to.
I go with understand him. I like to give that like a back and forth, I think.
There's some close-ups of Billy's eyes where it just, you definitely get the impression that he's understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
It is slightly tricky and troubling. At least, you know, they're in New York apartment buildings. You get the impression that Billy's mom sort of puts him out in the corridor so he can see the world go by. He can experience a bit of life. And at least Sexton does stop and talk to him. But it is at times a little bit strange. And again, 27 years later, we might see it written differently, I think. Okay. You mentioned the reactions of men in this story, because I had an idea that most of the men that we encounter in this 24-hour period are not great. Whereas the female characters, with the possible exception of the punky biker gang of girls at the start who assault Mad, or try to assault Mad Hetty, they're all pretty, the female characters are much more positive in this book. Hazel, Fox, Dee Dee, and we haven't mentioned Mrs. Robbins, the sort of cheerful market stall lady who lives in the same apartment and explains the universe's backstory without realising it.
Yeah.
I mean, are all the blokes a bit rubbish in this one?
Possibly.
Yes, okay.
I think so. I mean, we've talked a little bit about representation of women and men in The Sandman, and also acknowledge that at this point the readership is 50-50 women and men, I think. And Death's obviously a popular character for female readers. So maybe, yeah, Neil Gaiman is giving us the chance to meet a few more female characters, you know, meet Mad Hetty, who we've never really properly met before, and get a little bit more of the world. Mrs. Robbins is a really delightful character. She's very friendly and warm. She also engages with what's going on, which is kind of rare. She, you know, Mad Hetty, she engages with Mad Hetty, and like, I think that's really great. But, you know, as it is my wont to point out, maybe the obvious here, she is also a black character and one of the few black faces we see in this issue, which is set in New York in the 90s, which it's, you know,
yeah.
And she's could be, as much as Dee Dee could be drawn as a manic pixie dream girl stereotype, Mrs. Robbins could be also a black stereotype of a woman who's very friendly, who's very mothering. You know, there's a history of that depiction.
She's slightly the black maid from Gone with the Wind, maybe, if I really go back. It's a little
that's,
bit.
I think that's the line you could draw, that sort of stereotype of a caring mother figure. It's not a bad stereotype, it's bad because it's the only one that ever exists, right?
Yes.
But she does add a depth and a warmth to this community vibe, which is very clear in this book. I think we see it quite a bit. We've seen it with Wanda and Barbie and Hazel and Foxglove when we saw them in Game of You, but this captures a very particular time of like community, which maybe, you know, has changed throughout the years. But you know, even the fact that like Sexton has connections to Hazel and Foxglove, and even the bully who's, or you know,
Theo,
the guy who's tormenting him, he knows him from school. Like, it's not big scary New York where everyone is strangers. This is a nicer community in New York where you know the person who sells fruit at the bottom of your apartment building. You know who's performing on stage down at the club. You know, like, the girl that you met in that club can ring someone and say, "I want to meet that guy again." You know, there's a, like, there's a warmth to this story, which is really lovely. And I think, like,
Yeah.
It's always nice to see a community being represented as like a good thing and as like an essential sort of part of life.
I mean, it's partly the effect of Dee Dee
exactly
deforming the universe, but everybody she meets, you know, the hot dog vendor, the taxi driver, the guy who runs the bagel coffee shop, they're all delightful, aren't they? They're all wonderful and friendly.
There's a lovely moment in the bagel coffee shop when Dee Dee and Sexton are being threatened once again by the Eremite, and the owner just sort of like shuffles him out, just is like, yep, okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. Just like, yeah.
It's another New York crazy.
Yeah, you know, like it's, but he's used to it. He treats him kindly. He just sort of shuffles him along. He treats Dee Dee and Sexton kindly after that. Sort of a, you know, yeah, there's a warmth that is brought to New York, maybe because of Dee Dee's presence.
Yeah.
But I do think we've seen it before, you know, even in A Game of You. I think Neil Gaiman brings that out. And I think, yeah, I don't know, maybe we talked, obviously, in the Kindly Ones, we were talking a little bit about LA and how sort of like LA is maybe the opposite of that in Neil Gaiman's eyes at this point.
Okay, so if you want to see a bit of 1993 New York where it's delightful and cozy and everybody seems to know each other and everybody's friendly and lovely apart from the bad guys, this is the one for you.
Yes. And email us if you want to know like page references for the tricky stuff we've mentioned, because we're happy to give those out.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there are some, as we say, some troubling issues, as there always is. But, you know, it's grown-up comics, and that's what we've been talking about, these grown-up serious issues that it does touch upon. An enjoyable miniseries, despite all that?
Definitely. I mean, like I said, obviously I'm privileged to be able to sort of avoid the problematic moments. But yeah, I've always enjoyed this storyline, this back and forth with Dee Dee and Sexton, and the way it sort of unfolds and resolves itself is very neat.
Yes. And
I've read the other spin-offs, and I'm trying to decide which one I like more, but I think I do like this one more. I think I do like Sexton. I like that he is a sort of kind of flawed character. He's not the brave male hero who we see quite a lot in stuff. He's just kind of like shambling and mopey and goes along with the flow, and then maybe comes out of this story a little bit happier than he went in, which is kind of, it's a realistic goal maybe, compared to some of the other sort of hero tales we've been given in Sandman.
Yes. Okay. I mean, I liked it. I did like it again this time. I liked it originally. I liked the Dee Dee in New York stuff. And the 24 Hours with Sexton is good. It does have a nice sort of beginning, middle and end feel to it. And whenever Mad Hettie turns up, it's always a good time as well. Mm-hmm. And she has quite a bit of agency in this story. She's the one who rescues them from this warehouse with Mrs. Robbins. I did enjoy it. I did, you know, those troubling issues did stand out to me.
I think they stand out more as we read, and possibly more because of how we've been rereading.
Because of the critique we've been bringing.
Yeah, we have been looking for stuff.
Looking for trouble.
And finding it, so, yeah, you know.
It's there. Cool. Anything else?
I don't think so.
So we do have spin-off episodes we are planning to do. Next week, hopefully, we will be back with... We're going to look at Jill Thompson.
Yeah.
So we're definitely going to do her two Little Endless books. And we'll see how we get on. We may fit in her manga-inspired At Death's Door as well. So that'll be in the next episode of A Handful of Dust on this feed, hopefully in a week or so's time. Until then, thank you very much for listening to A Handful of Dust. I'm Eamon.
And I'm Jenny.
And goodbye.
Goodbye.